Well, you know, I can't believe that. I've never worn socks in the shower.
David McCookie.
Yes?
David McCookie.
My gosh, what? Sorry, I'm a few minutes late. I forgot I had to set up my iPhone and I was practicing my Josh Groban impression, so.
Josh Groban's voice is a touch higher than mine.
Actually, I think
though not
so,
as velvety.
I've come to two conclusions after listening to several of his songs. One is, and this comes from, you know, years of experience, I've concluded that the better the lead vocalist is, the worse the synthesizers that surround him are.
What a weird observation.
I was listening to some, well, first of all, almost all of his like most widely known songs are, what do you call it? Christmas songs. Like that's his thing, you know, his Christmas album. And then secondly, it's just all really, really bad synths.
Yeah, there's no full orchestra on on these numbers.
I'm not even sure they upgraded from GarageBand to Logic Pro.
Josh Groban, I've never really listened to much.
Me neither.
Him. But I remember I'm a band geek. I was doing mostly band. But I was in choir for a semester in high school, just for fun. I was taking AP music. Taking AP music theory. And they recommended that I go through choir to help learn, you know, the steps between the notes. You know, is it a third? Is it a fifth? An octave? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
a ninth.
We sang a Josh Groban song and they played it for us during choir. And it was actually like one of the better songs I've ever heard. It was all in Italian. And
Ave Maria?
No, not that one.
Because he's known for that one too.
He is known for that one. Yes, that's
such
right.
Papist nonsense. So much.
But I think that's his best song. And I'm gonna link it for everybody if they care to.
I guess this is going in the show. I was just, confessing my deep, dark secret of trying to imitate him.
But the thing that I'm getting at, though, is there's a lot of synth in that song. I don't think there's really.
Yeah.
It sounds like there's an orchestra playing behind him, but I think a lot of that's artificial. But yeah. It's cheap, right? If you're producing an album.
Yep. You know, yep. That's how you do it.
Like when you and I did that album, we didn't want to pay in a whole orchestra, so we did it all via synth.
Right.
It was just so much better for us.
Well, that was how I did.
Illuminated in purple. What is that? You're like violet. What?
Really?
Yeah. Like your mic equipment's all. Oh, there we go. That's weird. Oh, that's it was so all bright. Purple.
Yeah, I don't know. My wallpaper was probably my primary lighting source.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And my wallpaper is here. I'll show violet. You. It's one of the defaults that comes with macOS. Da, da, da.
Ooh, that's pretty. I like
Thank
that.
Thank you. You're pretty. Sorry, that's the thing I say to my wife. That was confusing.
Your mom's pretty.
Thank you.
Then all of a sudden, like, we're insulting each other, but by the end, we're all feeling warm and fuzzy and happy. I know, isn't that right? Yeah.
Thanks. I spent extra time on my mascara today.
I'm gonna tell my sons. Whenever they get into a fight, here's how you diffuse it. Just tell them they're pretty.
There's a trend on TikTok of men pretending to be really mad about how beautiful their wife or girlfriend is.
Okay.
And it's just silliness. That's all that it is. So point two about Josh Groban is, I think he spends much of his time where his voice is strongest, which is not the upper tenor range. He spends the time in that overlap between baritone and tenor. And very rarely in his songs does he actually like delve into that upper territory. And his voice holds together in that territory too. But like the majority of his voice, I think, is actually in a vocal range that you and I can achieve.
I've always thought that that meant that he didn't have a high vocal range, that he just couldn't sing up there.
I don't know.
A lot of his songs are low. I've never really noticed that.
Like he's known as a tenor and he technically is, but I mean, he doesn't really like a tenor. Dive into the deep end or the high end of the tenor pool title.
I have converted all my stuff on my work computer to dark mode. The stuff that does, and I like it. I really do.
I have come to a conclusion, and it is this. I just told this to Sarah, and I felt like it needed to go somewhere. I was going to tweet it, but I'll just say it here. I think that when macOS asks you, "Do you want to use dark mode?" it's basically asking, "Do you want all of your stuff?" except old websites that we can't control and a few older, less frequently updated applications to be in dark mode. When Windows asks it, because I've been using Windows a lot this week, that is neither here nor there. It is essentially asking you the question, would you like for about 12 of your applications to be in dark mode and for everything else to ignore me?
Oh,
when Linux asks you if you want to enable dark mode, it is basically asking you, Would you like for the application that controls whether or not you're in dark mode to be in dark mode, and for three other applications to do it, and for like eight of your applications to be completely in light mode as if nothing had happened, and for the rest of your system to be completely broken and unreadable because it's black on black?
If so, click yes.
The podcast you are about to hear contains the histrionic and problematic conversations of a stodgy Presbyterian and a casserole-loving Baptist. Their interactions are volatile at times and unpleasant most of the time. In many nations, this is considered a mild form of torture. We strongly advise you to stop this nonsense and go do something useful with your life. Otherwise, if you insist on listening to this mess, welcome to the lightest form of flogging.
Thank you, Deep Voice Man. I also welcome you to the Lightest Form of Flogging podcast, episode 120. Milestone. Yes. I am your host, Jim. I never made it to Biblical Hebrew, and sitting across the country from me in a contraction negotiated 824 miles is my co-host, David, who never did either, but still prefers to read his Psalter in the original Hebrew. Yeah. I don't know why I'm clapping. I just did that automatically. I apologize for me clapping.
That was our listeners. They were doing it uncontrollably and didn't even realize it.
Sometimes we have an in-studio audience. How's everybody doing? Your show sucks. Hey, sir, leave. Okay.
I can't see David. He's 824 miles away. I have a great view of Jim, though.
Yes. I just realized that I forgot to illuminate my face. I'm kind of shrouded in darkness and secrecy, much like my covenant theology. Mm. So I apologize for that, but I'm going to be a little bit dark, as I usually am.
Honestly, it's nice not really being able to see any detail in your facial area.
I have been waiting and waiting and waiting, and finally Jim did it.
Jim Briggs, now in 4K. No, nobody wanted that.
Everyone gets up and leaves the theater. I ain't doing this.
I was okay with it when it was 480p.
Oh, boy. Hey, show. Let's do this thing.
Hi, show.
We march ever forward. You want to do it? Ever onward. Flogging has not stopped, nor is it ever going to stop until the next time Jim quits the show. So let's go ahead and start.
The flogging will continue until morale improves.
Yes. Why don't you go ahead and get started?
Okay.
I'm gonna do,
you should do one first.
Okay. So apparently, our beloved listener, longtime listener, Brad, from our Slack channel, said that we did not specify, specificate, the show that you and I talked back and forth on in our last follow-up.
When he said that, I was like, oh no.
We talked about Lost for like 15 minutes, and he said that we didn't really specify the show, and he figured it out.
Yeah, at first he was lost, but then he realized.
Thank you. Okay. You want to talk about something? Let's talk about something. Me and my wife watched this show. It's a sitcom, actually. It's called Last Man Standing with Tim Allen. You ever heard of it?
Yeah,
based in Denver, Colorado. Where you live.
That makes sense.
And he's a funny guy, obviously. Comedian. Has great writers. Drops a lot of really funny lines. Well, that was old Tim Allen. That was from Home Improvement. He doesn't do that in this one.
Okay.
But in the show, his wife is not... I mean, the actress is not really a comedian, but she has some funny lines written for her, but she does a lot of bad puns. But in the show, like it's like a meta bad pun. Like everyone knows she doesn't know how to deliver it, but she does. And it's like funny indirectly. Mm. It's like this contest that she has, like the worst kind of pun she could make. And it like really upsets her husband, played by Tim Allen. And my wife is starting to do this to me. And today I got back from the doctor from an ear infection. And I have lots of vertigo, so everything's spinning. And she has dropped by and uttered about six spin jokes to me. And said, like, it asked me if I wanted a spin machine or something for Christmas and all sorts of things. And it's just like that woman from Last Man Standing.
Mm, and, I relate to that because I don't know it.
Okay, good. Okay. That's a little weird. But anyways... So speaking of being lost, I listened back today and you actually did say Lost right at the beginning. Did you listen back to it?
I listened. I thought he was right, but I wasn't paying that close of attention because it's our show and I can't.
Yeah. And it was you and me talking. So
yeah.
Why would you?
I was just grinding my teeth.
I guess we'll never know, Jim, is what David says, but I listened to it. No, we did specify the actual show. So, Brad, you're wrong. You're so, you're just so wrong. And I don't know what to say about that. So there you go. This next time, we'll make sure we specify to a greater degree of specificity. So there you go. There's
that
mine.
Was well said. So well said. Let's see here. I need to update you, Jim, because I know you care quite passionately about this. We just finished last night, Lost, season 1, episode 10, Raised by Another. And by another. Sarah said to me, what?
The blonde, what was her name?
Oh, good. You don't remember either. I'm on the Wikipedia page.
She's like my least favorite character.
Do you want me to tell you?
Yeah. What is her name?
Claire.
Oh, Claire. Or as the Australians call her, Claire. Claire. Craig, you're listening? Claire.
I just can't bother. They cannot be bothered to pronounce the R.
Okay.
We're in a hurry.
So Raised by Another, what do you think?
So at the end of it, Sarah turns to me and she goes, okay, I'm hooked. And I thought,
yes,
I am now interested to see where this goes. Not specifically because of that episode. We also watched Solitary and Confidence Man since the last time.
Okay. So you saw Sawyer's.
Yep. Yep, yep.
I can't remember what Solitary was. That was Saeed. Okay. Yep. That was a good episode.
Yeah. That was the one that I think kind of started to clinch it for me. Cause that was pretty interesting. So we're on board now. I mean, I doubt we'll be stopping.
Good. The flashbacks are not meaningless. I mean, I don't think you believe this, but I just want to reiterate that they're not just doing that for effect. It's not just like a show device.
Mm.
It's not filler. There are actually lots of, I don't know if this is the right term or phrase, but there's a lot of Easter eggs. There's lots of tie-ins in those flashbacks that display their connectedness.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll understand as it goes on. But those flashbacks are for real, brah. But anyways, yeah. Well, that's good. I'm glad you're liking it. I'm glad Sarah's hooked. When Sarah says, oh, I'm just so hooked on this show. That's, she doesn't say it like that. But David says, what did you say? Like, I am now interested
to see where this goes. Yeah,
okay, there you go. That's what David says when he's really into the show. Like when Mandalorian season 1, episode 1.
Oh, no, I'm
one
hooked
ended,
on Mandalorian.
David said, I believe I will enjoy this show in the continuing...
No, I was so happy. I can't think of anything, actually. I was realizing when season 2, episode 1 came on, or when it ended, I was like, I think this is like my favorite thing that I've watched. Like, it just makes me so happy.
Time?
Maybe,
all
yeah.
Time?
Yeah.
David, that's a big claim.
I know.
Wow. I like that.
But certainly within recent history, you know? The Lord of the Rings is up there, too, and that's a challenge. But that's coming later in follow-up.
Like TV show, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For TV show, that makes it a little bit easier. I do feel like I can probably answer in the affirmative there.
But you were thinking, I guess I got this wrong. You were thinking that whether it's a TV show or a movie, The Mandalorian is one of the better things that you've watched, possibly really up top there at number one.
Yep.
Wow.
Not number zero, though. That's reserved.
That's reserved for...
Oh, I don't know. I just keep it in reserve.
The Big Bang Theory. No, I don't know. Okay.
You are next, sir.
Sorry. Last week, I listened back through the parts of the episode. I don't listen to previous... I edit them, so I listen to them enough.
Right.
But I believe that the mix was pretty bad.
Really?
Especially on the bits. Like the Reform Moron podcast, the music was way too low.
Oh.
And I just had trouble working with that. I don't know if it's because of my ear or what, but...
Maybe your ear is what's gaslighting you now. Have you ever thought about that?
Possibly. Godfather Flogging Theater was okay, but some mix issues in there. So I apologize if the mix was frustrating.
Oh yeah, I did notice that at the very end when you had the long rain and then the gunshot. I did notice that I kind of couldn't hear the rain. I had noise cancellation on, but I was walking by a somewhat noisy road, so it's hard to say.
Okay. All right. All right.
Point
taken and discarded.
Let's see here. I didn't think it was that bad, though. I didn't actually notice, other than that thing at the end where I remembered when I listened to it on my headphones at home that there was rain, and while I was walking, I didn't hear it. That was the only thing I noticed. So don't feel bad, Jim.
Here it comes again. The rain. Here comes the rain again.
Here comes the rain. Doo-doo-doo-doo. That's the 2020 version.
I was thinking of a song that's more akin to your dark emo presentation you have going right now. David looks like he's in an Ingmar Bergman film.
I have exactly one working light in here, and it's on my desk. Yes. I have an overhead light that, like, have you seen these things, Jim? Hold on.
What?
Have you seen?
I can see your eye. What?
These bizarre.
Those are called light switches.
No, that. You see that?
Oh.
It's got Jim, all these buttons these on it. It's devices? Like somebody decided, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you could lose your light switch? Like, wouldn't that be great if like it came off the wall and you could lose it in the couch? Doesn't that make sense? Well, I hate
that's a
these
problem
things
I think consumers
so
really
much.
Want to have. Okay. Oh, Denver apartments, they're weird, huh?
Well, we encountered this when we were living in the basement too, but that one actually worked. This one, like, you just have to hold down the light turn on button for the overhead. There's an overhead ceiling fan in here. And what I'm talking about, guys, listeners, is this like removable wall mounted remote control that controls the fan and the lights.
Yes.
And I've never had cause to remove it. Like, this room is like maybe 10 feet by, I don't know, 12 feet, something like that. It's a very small room. And I can't imagine not like being able to just reach over and touch it because I'm very tall. So like, why would I want it moved? But then beyond that, it works like you have to swap batteries in it because it's not like properly plugged into anything. And to turn the lights on and off is just really, really annoying. And sometimes you can't.
There are two light switches that you showed me. Are those for the lights?
One of them controls the outlet that I almost plugged my computer into and then realized.
There's a light switch installed for an outlet.
Yes.
But they needed to give you a remote for the actual light. There are two light switches that I saw. Are either of them for the overhead light?
I think at one time, the one closest to the remote was, but it does not seem to do anything anymore.
But okay, so neither of the light switches are actually controlling the overhead light,
yes.
But they're next to a remote that does control the overhead light, but needs batteries.
Okay, and that also is doesn't actually quite work correctly.
Okay, great. You know,
I gave Sarah
when
the
you first
office.
Started explaining this, I don't think I cared that much, but now I'm like mad. I'm mad with you. That is pretty weird.
So anyway, I bought an Amazon like lamp, like a floor lamp that I need to set up and install, but I just haven't had time. So I'm limited to basically this one light in this room. And now I have the door closed, so I'm not even getting ambient light.
All right.
Anyway, that's why I look the way that I do. Well, in terms of lighting. next
funny.
Up, I shared. So I was challenged. The gauntlet was thrown down, as you would say. I was challenged to provide sources for my quote about the Westminster Divines and the Psalter. I actually learned a lot. It turns out that the 1650 metrical Psalter was actually commissioned by the Westminster Assembly, I believe, of 1648. And so they sent out,
assembly,
like three or four guys, they split up the Psalter and they gave each of them some number of Psalms to translate. And then those were
ripped it in half.
Huh?
Nothing. I was just making a joke that wasn't funny.
Then, those men brought their translations back. Then there was a committee appointed to like carefully study the translations and make modifications. And then at the 1650 Westminster Assembly, the entirety of the Psalter was read out loud and everybody voted whether or not to approve it for use in their churches. And so that was the 1650 Psalter is actually arguably like essentially the Westminster translation of the Psalms, which I did not realize. These are some of the quotes.
And they christened it or declared it to be a very faithful, their own translation they said was a faithful translation.
Yes.
Or the okay, all right.
Yes, I recognize the problem
this
there.
This is guys, this is like the best ever.
But
which is a quote David's about to
you
read.
You get to do that when you are the Westminster Assembly.
Okay, point taken.
But thank you.
Still
they also approved the Westminster Confession. Like I don't know what the problem here is.
Well, of course.
Anyway,
of course
things don't. They said about it were that it was more plain, smooth, and agreeable to the text than any heretofore. Robert Braille, who was involved in some
who
way, but he was also
here, Dr. Strange. Sorry.
He was on the Westminster Assembly. He said that the Psalms are perfected, the best without a doubt that ever yet were extant.
Is he rapping there?
I believe so.
What am I even doing here?
And then final quote was put out at some point by the assembly. This might be in the minutes. I'm not sure. But they said, yet the other version, referring to this version, which is confusing, that it is so exactly perused and amended with long and great labor, it is so closely framed according to the original text as we humbly conceive it will be useful for the edification of the church.
Okay. He goes on to say it was totally lit.
So that's all. I just thought I was challenged for a source on my quote when I said some of the Westminster Divines said that it was one of the best translations ever. Technically, that is the official opinion of the Westminster Assembly of 1650.
And you know what? You done produced those quotes, son. So,
Dad?
So take that. What?
Dad?
Oh, Dad?
It's my favorite way to respond when people call me son, especially to my dad.
You could have been a doctor, but you turned out to be a graphic designer. So it looks like you're going to be really helpful to the world, son. Thanks, Dad. Did you ease up on the sarcasm?
Oh, no. I wouldn't notice the sarcasm. That's the supposed autism thing. I would just interpret it benevolently.
Allegedly.
Next up is Jim.
Mandalorian definitely doesn't suck. I just have to say, I think the last two episodes, the last episode especially.
Are you caught up?
I think caught up. Let's just say this. Oh, no. I think the show finally gave me what I have been wanting. Secretly, not so secretly, which is a little bit of character development. I wanted a lot of it. Because it's just, I'm just kind of getting tired of seeing Mando go on missions for people.
Right.
And he has Baby Yoda in his satchel.
Right.
Like Jack Bauer. Like Jack Bauer's satchel he used in 24.
Oh, I thought you were saying like he also had Jack Bauer in his satchel. Like just as a backup.
Probably would help him.
Yeah. You
know? I mean,
yeah.
Anyways, so I saw a little bit of development. I was actually really surprised at the performance of the comedian. Oh gosh, what is this? Why is my mind doing this? My mind.
It's your ear.
My mind. Oh, for Pete's sake, Jim, what's his name? You know who this man is.
Who does he play?
He plays the inmate that they went and got and utilized him for another freaking mission.
I didn't realize he was a comedian. It wasn't a mission. It was not a mission.
Yes, it was. It was a mission to go do a thing, and
Jim
did it.
Everything is a mission. If you set out to do something, everything is a mission. That's like that's how life works. We set out to do things. Like I'm on a mission to explain to you that everything is a mission right now. You could say that about you could say that about every episode of every single show, every A plot, every B plot. It's all missions.
It's all mission, Jim. The Baptist board says to another name.
Everything is missions.
Okay, Bill Burr. Bill Burr plays
what a good name.
The bald guy. Really, he's a famous comedian. Really, really talented, sharp-witted, awesome comedian. Plays a fairly good, not a dramatic turn, but he has some genuine moments that require some skill on screen.
Yeah,
and I think he came through, and I really liked it. But anyways, I'm happy with where it's going.
I hope you would be.
They're doing a little bit more than what they usually do.
Yep.
And you, of course, refuse to see that.
What?
Much like your opinions on The Last Jedi.
All right, whatever. Let's see here. Next up, there was follow-up on our two episodes where we talked about psalm singing, the last two episodes. There was follow-up on the Balm and Gilead podcast in the most recent episode, which I believe is episode 25. Okay. That's all that I have. I don't really have any responses. Brian dived a lot into translation theory and said several things, and I'm not qualified to respond, so I will not. Last for me is I mentioned last week the scene with Galadriel where she yells out, "All shall love me in despair." And you said, I seem to remember her not doing that in the book. And then I remembered that my copy of the book is digital and has finery place. So I thought I would cite for you. And now at last it comes. You will give me the ring freely. In place of the Dark Lord, you will have a queen. And I shall not be dark, but beautiful and terrible as the morning and the night. Fair as the sea and the sun and the snow upon the mountain. Dreadful as the storm and the lightning. Stronger than the foundations of the earth. All shall love me in despair. She lifted up her hand. And from the ring that she wore, there issued a great light that illumined her alone and left all else dark. She stood before Frodo, now tall beyond measurement, and beautiful beyond enduring, terrible and worshipful. Then she let her hand fall, and the light faded, and suddenly she laughed again, and lo, she was shrunken, a slender elf woman clad in simple white, whose gentle voice was soft and sad. "I pass the test," she said. "I will diminish and go into the West and remain Galadriel."
Best episode of Sheologians ever. So apparently it did happen.
Remind me, I have something to tell you about that after.
Okay. So I guess that's pretty close, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if Tolkien imagined Galadriel being as kind of creepy.
Yeah.
I think she still has to be beautiful in that description.
Yeah.
And worshipful. And the stuff that we got from the movie was pretty, repelling, I would say.
Yeah. It was not well done. But I can understand reading this. If I was like, if somebody came to me and I was the VFX guy and they're like, "We're going to do this," I'd be like, "What?" Cause there's a bunch of contradictions in there.
Okay.
I probably would have leaned heavily on like rim lighting, even though like I probably would have just contradicted some of the things in it. I would have said, I'm going for something that will get a look that I feel like is in the spirit of this description, even though like what Tolkien described is physically impossible with light.
Okay. Yeah. I guess they did their best. You know, they did that again, in The Hobbit. She had a transfiguration, whatever it is. And I think it was actually worse.
I don't think it's that. Really? I'll have to find
David had to mention that. it's more like a transmogrification. I don't know. They did it again in The Hobbit. And it got worse, I think.
Really?
Like the effect, if it was unintended, and when it happened in The Fellowship of the Ring, was just made worse when they did it in The Hobbit. I think it was in The Battle of Five Armies or Desolation of Smaug or Smog or Smog. Or smoke? Or Snoke? I don't know.
You just keep going. I'm looking for this scene on the YouTube.
Okay. The Eye of Sauron appears to a bunch of people that were never in the book. This was Elrond and Saruman.
I cannot believe they were made by the same person. It's just depressing.
I saw a video that kind of explained a lot of why The Hobbit failed so deeply and magnificently. Do you remember that Guillermo del Toro, the famous artistic director, was actually slated to direct a trilogy with his kind of flair? And through delays, he eventually quit the production. And I think Universal was making these, if I'm not mistaken. They told Peter Jackson, "Hey, look, our director is gone and we need you to step in and direct these movies. We're starting very, very soon." And that was Guillermo del Toro's preparation, not his preparation. So he had to start over on a lot of that stuff. And as he was filming, he was writing, storyboarding, conceptualizing, and designing production as he was going. So he was really making it up as he went along, kind of like how George Lucas did the prequels. Just kidding. If the movie felt like it just wasn't really well put together, at least story-wise, felt like it was just, not as deeply emotionally powerful.
Right.
I think that's why. And I think those movies were wasted. His effort was wasted because he was being rushed and should have been two movies instead of three. But
yeah. And then Jackson's decision to go with 48p also just bugs me every time I watch it. The frame rate also being higher and looking like a soap opera. It's just like at every turn, it felt like, oh, we could do the wrong thing or something that wouldn't be horrible. No, let's do the wrong thing.
Skid idea. Let's do a soap opera version of Galadriel's transmorphification.
It keeps changing.
All shall love me and despair. Sorry.
Title.
I don't know what I'm doing anymore.
I'm going to get a picture of you and apply the same effects to it as they did to Galadriel.
Not dark, but beautiful.
All right. Do you want to start the show?
Sure. My ear infection is causing me to cough.
I know. Why that is?
Why?
Because all that stuff in your ear is draining down your throat. Which is actually a good sign.
Oh, good. Yeah, our listeners will agree. Let's do a quick musical break, and then we'll get into the main topic of the show. Okay. Mm-hmm, okay. Mm-hmm,
We'll be right back.
back in the saddle again, separate saddles. My voice is a little raw, as the British
separate
say,
horses.
From my last coughing fit. And but we're going to go ahead and soldier on. So we're going to do a discussion on a David idea. It's not a Davisode or a Davidisode. This is just David has an idea and we're going to talk about it. So,
okay.
David always struggles during these introductions, which is why I do them, which is a huge mistake because I have nothing either. So
it's very difficult to introduce a topic in a quasi-formal way on a show where nothing's really supposed to sound formal. It's all kind of, except for the skits and stuff.
Yes.
It's all kind of supposed to sound like, oh, this is just natural conversation.
But you'd think we'd figure it out by episode 120. Still awkward after all these years. But no, we're going to talk about spectrum versus category thinking. This is an interesting topic. The notes looked promising, David. So let's go ahead and give it a shot.
Thank you.
So what prompted this? Let's talk about that way. That's a good way to ease in.
Oh,
what prompted
this? Isn't in my notes. I don't know. So it's actually been a number of just different conversations with people where I am struggling to understand. See, the problem is this was prompted like 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Okay.
But it's been situations in which I'm struggling to get them to admit the existence of a category that at present is not even on their radar. Like, it's one thing to convince somebody of an idea that they have heard of and that they believe exists mm-hmm. in the world. It's another thing to get somebody to believe that an idea completely outside of their thinking previously exists, let alone is correct, especially if they feel like they really do understand what they're thinking about.
You know, we might be jumping ahead, but why do you think that is? I'm very curious about this. I too have thought these thoughts and have felt these feelings. Yes. Why is it so hard for people to conceive of someone who thinks differently than they do?
Well, Jim, I think it's because of spectrum versus category thinking.
Sounds like a great idea.
I think part of it is if you feel like you have, so Chesterton talks about this and I don't quote him often because Wilson quotes him all the time and I don't want to be like Wilson, but yes. Chesterton talks about the crazy person and he talks about how the crazy person isn't crazy because he's very bad at reasoning. He doesn't start with, I see something with feathers, therefore I know it's a potato. Like he's not that kind of crazy. Like very few people are that kind of crazy where they just move to complete and utter non sequiturs. Most crazy people think in very tight rational circles, but they think in very small rational circles.
Okay.
And so what that leads to is they have this presupposition that they believe down in the core of their being that, that they are dead. I think this is the example that he uses, or it's something like the example. So he's this man is just convinced that he is dead, and he goes to a doctor, and the doctor says, you know, what's wrong? And he says, well, I'm dead, and I'm probably butchering this analogy. And the doctor says, well, I don't think you're dead. He says, no, I really am. I know in my soul that I am dead. And the doctor says, well, you know, you're talking to me. You're breathing. What did you have for breakfast this morning? You know, oh, eggs and toast. You had eggs and toast for breakfast this morning. These are all things like that a dead person couldn't do. And the man says, oh my gosh, this is amazing. That's a really good point. I guess dead people can do these things. Because they are trapped in this circle. There is a presupposition. There is an assumption that they are unwilling or unable to challenge. And they, for this man, the challenge is that he is dead, or the assumption is that he is dead. And I think for a lot of people that may not be as explicit as a single truth, as a simple truth, like I am dead, but it may be something like, for example, if you believe that you are either dead or alive and there is no in between and nothing outside of that, a person is either dead or alive, then you would have a great deal of difficulty admitting the existence of zombies, which, I mean, I actually happen to hold to that presupposition and I do not admit the existence of zombies, but you can see how that would work. How if you thought that these are the two categories and you're trying to tell me about something outside of it, A, I don't understand it. And B, I don't even believe in it. I believe in a Boolean, in a binary decision. You're dead or you're alive.
Okay. Clearly you've never been to Florida. Sorry.
No. I know.
That's an easy joke. That's an easy joke.
So do you have any thoughts on that?
The point about, you know, crazy people are very rarely just, you know, flat, you know, bat-ass crazy. where they just go in all sorts of irrational places, and it's just a stream of consciousness thinking out loud. Most people are rational about their craziness, but it's just that it's a very small circle, like you said, but they're presupposing mm-hmm. something that's incorrect. They're presuppositions. Right. They're believing something to be true about another truth that's incorrect, and that's where it goes wrong. And that happens over time, and it's a very powerful error. It's an entrenched error, because if we can just feel so confident that we're right about something, it feels good and it feels right, but you also think it's right because you've just spent all this time going through this process in your head. And that's very, very, very difficult to break. And I don't know, I think this has always been true, but I think lately, because of various circumstances, we're even more politicized and divided than we've ever been.
Mm.
And people are becoming very entrenched mm-hmm. and believing the things they previously believed 5 years ago, like tenfold now. Mm-hmm. And even to the point, if you do not believe what they believe, you are clearly
Hitler.
And they really, I don't think they're just throwing this out there just for a rhetorical effect. I think they truly believe that you are similar to Hitler if mm-hmm. you vote for Trump, or vice versa. And mm-hmm. I'm just like, how did we get here? How did we get here? It was bad 5 years ago. It was bad 10 years ago. It was mm-hmm. bad even before that. But there's something different about it right now. And I don't know how we got here. Obviously, me just saying, oh, their presuppositions are wrong is just, you know, it's like a deflated, you know, it's just, that doesn't make, that that's not enough. That doesn't go deep enough. Obviously, it doesn't, but just kind of thinking out loud.
Yeah. I think too that when you I feel like I have sort of a category of, this might explain a lot about me, but I feel like I have this category of like core tenets. Like I could write a sort of manifesto of like, these are things that David absolutely believes are true about the world, okay. like in the core of his soul. And when those things are challenged and you end up like the notion of giving up on one of those core things is challenged, you kind of feel like, well, I had this category of like absolute truth. And if something in that is wrong, how do I know that all the other things in it are not wrong? Like,
that was funny.
How do I know that? Sorry, my microphone just like sad trombone fell over.
That's pretty funny.
If this one thing is not true, this one thing that is like core to everything I believe about the world, how do I know that these other things are not true? And so like, if you down in the core or the soul of your being believe that Republicans are good and Democrats are evil, and somebody challenges you and says, you know, Republicans have had lots of opportunities to stop abortion, I think maybe they haven't done it because they want your vote next election. Like when somebody comes along and says that, whether it's legitimate or not, you accepting that means saying that some core part of what you believe to be true about the world is wrong. And it feels like it's a slippery slope from there to, well, maybe the Bible isn't true, or maybe God isn't real, or maybe like, but I was trying to say, listeners, I'm not sure if Jim is going to include this or not, but what just happened was Jim's internet cut out. And then we tried to do a phone call to record instead of Skype because his internet is not working. And Jim is on Android. So we're like 10 minutes later, Jim has finally figured out how to get the Russian mail order bride ads off his phone, and he's able to talk to me. And
I called David 9 times. We finally did it.
So anyway, what I was saying before we disconnected was, I think the notion of a core presupposition being challenged is scary, because it makes you question all of the other ones. If I could be wrong about this, could I also be wrong about baptism or the Bible as a whole or the existence of God or, you know, name any core presupposition that you have. One of them being wrong is kind of a scary place to be.
Are we saying that it's wrong that they are connected? Or are you saying that, I mean, we should probably start talking about our main topic here pretty soon, but are you saying that if you're thinking categorically, it can be safe to challenge a presupposition or a different presupposition or a collection of them? Or if you are a spectrum thinker, all of these things being interconnected is actually as dangerous as it sounds. Like if one goes down, all the rest of them will. Is that what you're saying? Or is this like a whole new thing?
I think this is kind of a whole new thing, because I was just responding to one of your questions. But I think what I would want to say is, I think in general, it can be good to have core suppositions that you don't let go of lightly. I think maybe you have a point there where like part of the problem is like, if you tie them all together as being true because you believe them so dearly, or they're so important to you, then that's not a helpful way to think about the world, because if one of them is wrong, all of them are up for debate. But if you take something like, well, scripture is true, and you take that on the authority of God's word, then that's not really affected by you having a sudden change in mind about politics or even any particular theological subject.
I think that's where we're now in safe territory when one can break down, because I think people are, I mean, this may sound just so stupid, but it's really hard for people to change. It's really hard for people to change their minds on things. At least that's how I think. It's taken a long time for me to change my mind on things. Like if someone gave me a rational argument that's true, it could take me 7 years to believe it. It could take me a really long time. And I hope I'm not alone. But part of the reason why I'm so afraid for something to change is that it might change something else. You know, like, oh, just my whole life is going to end. And I need to stop. I think I need to stop doing that, because I need to think back at the times that I have changed something that's a significant tenet, whether that's political or theological. My life didn't end. In fact, it might have actually gotten better because I fixed something. Right. You know, so maybe this categorical thinking versus spectrum thinking can speak to that a little bit, you know. But anyways, before we get too far crazy here, we should probably succinctly define. Or not defined, but just declare what we're talking about before too long, David.
Yeah. So I could explain this. And it's worth pointing out, this is kind of a broader topic that I have been doing a lot of thinking about lately. And it is, I think about how I think and how it is different from how other people think. So this isn't like what my opinions are and how those opinions are different from others. But I keep hearing the phrase on some programming podcasts, the notion of reasoning about things, like how you reason about things. I don't know if it's at all helpful, but a programming metaphor here is like object-oriented programming is arguably really nothing more than a different way of thinking about how to solve computer science problems. And in object-oriented programming, rather than writing a bunch of functions, like a bunch of lists of tasks for the computer to do, and then telling them to do these lists of tasks in a list of task order. You create what are called objects, and objects are things like in the real world that have attributes and can do things. And you build your program in an almost skeuomorphic way, in an almost like metaphorical to the real world sort of way, where you create a bunch of objects that have attributes and things that they can do, and you pass these objects around between objects, and they do things with the object and change attributes and that sort of thing. That probably was not helpful at all, but the way that you think about something can be very fundamental to the conclusion that you come to it, come to with it. I have found, an example of like how you think about stuff, this is similar to something we previously discussed at the end of episode 116, where I kind of brought up the question of like, what are statistics good for? Like, what is reasonable to learn from statistics, and what is maybe going too far? What can statistics actually say versus what do people draw out of them that may or may not be legitimate? So that's an example of like, oh, how do you, like somebody tells you 70% of people do X, but like, how do you think about that statistic? What does that mean? Does that mean 70% of people, like there's a 70% likelihood that somebody is going to do something, or like, how do you think about that? So I actually have three different topics that have come out of this for me that we may talk about at some point. One of them is the idea of unforced versus forced errors, and doing things wrong that you cannot reasonably be blamed for. The second one is the act of making a case for the viability of a position versus making a case for the position itself. These are things that I use all the time in my thinking that I think are actually really quite critical, at least to how I function. And then the third one, which is what we're talking about today, although we've done our best not to, is the notion of thinking in terms of a spectrum versus thinking in terms of a category. Don't get me wrong. I think that digression was excellent. I really liked what we did there. But anyway, so let me define this, unless you have something to interject at this point.
No.
Let's see. So it's going to be difficult for me to describe spectrum thinking because I think I've done a half decent job of largely purging it from my thinking, not because I think that it is like morally wrong to think this way, but because just in so many areas of my life, I have decided, oh, that's not a helpful way to think about it, and started thinking about it, the things in a different way. So spectrum thinking, I think, typically starts with the presupposition that there are two concepts, positions, or states of being which are inherently opposed to each other. From here, it is then stated that there is a line between the two positions, and people will fall into various points along the line, sometimes landing at one of the, like exactly at one of the two opposites. So an interesting example that Jim alluded to earlier is Republican versus Democrat. And a lot of politics is divided into these two distinctions. And then along comes somebody like a libertarian, and you realize he doesn't really fit into anywhere in the line.
What like, is this if anything, person saying?
If anything, maybe there should be an extension on the other, you know, on each side of the line, so that beyond Republican, you would find libertarian, and beyond Democrat, you would find socialist.
Do you think that a libertarian would be found beyond, if we're talking about a spectrum,
well, I don't,
beyond or before, you know, because I don't know if you noticed that, but like, is a libertarian more conservative or less? I've always wondered that. I've always thought that they were kind of less.
And that's kind of what I mean is, go ahead.
I was thinking that like a libertarian that's okay with like, you know, toking a bowl every now and then, surely he is left if we're on the spectrum than to the right.
Right.
You know, where a Republican would be. But hey, but you know what? I'm open. You know, I'm not a libertarian expert. All I know is that I don't like listening to them talk. So but no, this is a great example, though. I mean, just like sometimes a libertarian would come, like if you've never seen a libertarian in the wild and you talk to them for the first time and you were a conservative, I mean, your brain would explode. I mean, you would just have no idea what to do with them. You have no clue to do with them.
Right. Like Ron Swanson, you know, like I don't think many people would say he's liberal on anything. And if anything, he's more conservative than a Republican. And that's actually like, so first of all, that's an excellent example because it really does show where spectrum thinking falls down. And it's exactly what you're talking about where like, you're like, oh wow, this guy's really far right. And then you find out his opinion on drugs or maybe even pornography. And you're like, whoa, hold on there, fellow. Or even abortion. Like a lot of libertarians are pro-abortion. And you're like, wait, hold on there, fellow. I was putting you over here, but now you're over there. And it's, you can't be in both places.
But your point is this is where the problems emerge.
Right. So a lot of people, to take it one step further, a lot of people realizing this difficulty will say that the spectrum is, that spectrum, Democrat versus Republican, is unhelpful, and they'll create two new opposites, like liberal and conservative, with a similar line between them into which everyone falls at various places. But then along comes somebody like me, who has some libertarian leanings, but wants to leave some matters up to wisdom, especially for solutions, like temporary solutions to sudden problems, but who also thinks that the state should support the Christian church and oppose public idolatry. So like, where does David fall on the spectrum?
Which would make like fundamentalist Baptists like really liberal compared to you, you know?
Right. It's very confusing.
Yes. And like and Russell like, Moore must be like a raging socialist to you sometimes.
There's some, not socialist, but a raging, I'm not going to use the word because I can't say it on air.
Yeah. You scare people when we, this is my fault for bringing him up. This is, if you thought theology was problematic, just listen to this guy in politics.
I'd rather talk about less than more.
Okay.
Anyway, so it's clear that like some of my opinions would put me squarely in the middle, but then I have other opinions that literally the entire spectrum would want me to recant of. And I think there are a lot of people who are at least a little bit like me in that they have opinions that mean they can't reasonably be placed on this spectrum. Now you may say, listener at home, that politics are a complicated thing. And maybe I just picked the wrong distinction. I picked something too complex. So I thought like, what's another thing that people use spectrum language for? And I thought of people who prefer relatively bland foods to people who prefer spicy foods. And this is a spectrum that I use. Like I generally am averse to most food that would be considered spicier than like medium salsa, or I could do a small amount of spicy salsa, but like that's my absolute limit. I recently accidentally ate some of a burrito that was ordered for Sarah. What happened was I ordered hers twice instead of one for me and one for her. And she put jalapenos on it. And I put them in my mouth and I was like, this physically hurts. I find this very unpleasant. Why would anyone do this?
David said this in a calm manner at Taco Bell. No.
It was a Skidoba and it was our couch. Anyway, I have learned that they're beyond that. Like, so the spectrum is one that I use most of the time. I think it's helpful, but I've realized recently that there is a distinction between spicy things that primarily burn your sinuses, like horseradish, and spicy things that primarily burn in your mouth, like spicy candies. And I sometimes refer to this distinction as green spicy versus red spicy. Though I really don't understand why I use this distinction. And I'm always surprised when people tell me that they understand exactly what I mean. Jim, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't eat radishes. So this particular example, I'm not quite sure, but I do understand your distinction. This is very easy for me because I despise both sensations. So,
right. And that's why I only recently learned about the category.
Okay. But no, I can get this, that people's taste can be very refined to the point where, you know, they would prefer it much more or prefer it much less for it to be spicy in one way versus another. I get that.
Yeah. And in my mind, the key distinction is like horseradish is the kind of thing where if you touch it to the roof of your mouth, you just kind of feel like the whole top of your head catch fire. Whereas there are other foods that don't really affect your sinuses, but like having them on your tongue feels like fire on your tongue.
Yes.
So anyway, I think this distinction means that it's possible for someone to love one kind of spicy and have a very high tolerance for it, but then to hate the other kind of spicy and have a very low tolerance for it. And the spectrum comes to the surface when someone's making you dinner and they ask, hey, how spicy do you like your food? And you say, oh, you know, I love really spicy food. Like I'm really high on the spicy end of the spectrum title. But then you later find out that the dinner is so the other kind of spicy that you can't even eat it. Although I suspect this problem is less common than the political distinctions I mentioned previously, but like even there, even with this one, with this example, that's relatively simple and applies a lot more, there still may be exceptions that exist outside of the spectrum.
Okay.
And this is kind of how I meant that it related to your question earlier of like, why are people hesitant to accept the existence of an idea that exists outside their system? Like when you have a clean distinction between liberal and Democrat or liberal and conservative, or like spicy versus doesn't like spicy, and somebody comes along and is like, hey, the way you think about the world is fundamentally too simplistic, and now you have to make your thinking about this more complicated. Like there's resistance there, even if only because of laziness.
Right. Yeah. But let's say you adopt this and you do make distinctions between green spicy versus red spicy. You all of a sudden become either less interesting or like really problematic at like a dinner party. So like this whole group of 20 people like just really hate spicy food, but you enjoy radishes. You know, and all of a sudden, like, it's really hard to order for you and you make the order like more complicated, and the person making the order is like, oh geez, I have to, okay, David, you know, let's write down David's, you know, his little preferences. It doesn't fit in. I would just rather order 20, you know, extra spicy hot jalapeno burritos or whatever. But this guy, he wants some but like politically speaking, doing that kind of stuff like really annoys people a lot. It becomes very difficult for them to categorize you, because when you can categorize somebody, it's easy for you to like in a lazy way describe the entirety of them or the entirety of their philosophy, or just to, you know, move them around your political chessboard a lot easier when you know a rook does this and a knight does that and a pawn can only do this. And when you like, and when your rules of movement on the chessboard are unknown to this other person, you can't play, I was about to say play ball, but you can't play chess with this person. And that's, you know, it's fine for you, but annoying for them. So there is like a cost to doing this, to kind of moving to more categorical thinking. And you kind of have to bear that, you know, you have to, when you're the odd duck in the room because of your lack of, or because of your increased nuance, there is a cost to this, you know? So that might be another reason why people don't want to do it.
Yeah. You become the kind of person where when somebody asks you a simple yes or no question, you start with, so, I do want to say, I think that spectrum thinking is usually best applied when there are actual numbers at play. So I thought, like, is there an example where spectrum thinking is relatively foolproof? And the example I thought of is when somebody asks you what temperature you prefer your room to be at. And you have, at that point, a spectrum that is from absolute zero to whatever temperature would be so hot that the heat it gives off would instantly incinerate every atom in the universe, at which time it would have nothing left to burn, which would mean it would slowly cool. Most people will pick somewhere in between those two extremes. But lots of people, like, it's worth noting, lots of people prefer different temperatures during different times of the year. But even these are expressed on that spectrum. The spectrum is called Fahrenheit or Celsius for our non-US listeners. But what you're doing there is you're expressing a spectrum. You have really cold on the one hand and really hot on the other hand. And you say, oh, I would like, a 68 degree room or whatever. That is legit spectrum thinking. What's that?
Yeah, that is. But think about it, like, what if like you just like you absolutely prefer, 72 degrees, and that is 73 is too much and 71 is just unbearable. You kind of, you can make a category of each degree, I guess. But, that being said, I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay. So now I guess the proposed solution, which at least for me, it has been the solution, which is categorical or category thinking. And the kinds of confusion that we've just talked about with Democrats and liberals and where do you put libertarians and all of that, I think this is a resolution to those problems. So this is the best analogy I came up with, and I'm not sure how helpful it will be to non-programmers, but I'm going to try to speak of this problem as if it were a computer science problem, but without using programmer talk or programmerese. And I think it may be helpful. So spectrum thinking essentially tries to compress everything about a given subject into a number between 1 and 100, or 1 and 255 if you're a developer. That's a joke. Thank you, David Latchett, for chuckling. So you come up with a figure called liberalness. Like, how much liberalness does Bob have? Oh, Bob has 37 liberalness. And this is useful when you're trying to store as little data as you can, or be as brief as possible in your explanation. Actually, true false statements are even briefer, but they, a spectrum admits a bit more nuance than true or false.
True.
And so, so it's helpful when you're trying to be brief and not take up a lot of storage just to be able to say very briefly, like, oh, this describes me. This aspect of me is described by I'm a 37 in liberalness or whatever. But it's also incredibly, and sometimes I think dangerously imprecise. Category thinking creates a grid or a set of criteria by which a thing is evaluated. And programmers, I'm referring to a dictionary. So liberalness would be a list of attributes, like for or against government intervention in area X, or for or against abortion. Although for or against abortion could actually be its own dictionary, its own list of attributes, like for or against abortion in this case, for or against abortion in that case. But then beyond that, you could have a category like for or against women pastors, or, you in a given area, you think of, oh, well, like, what are all the questions that people have to answer in politics? Like, what are at least all the controversial questions that people have to answer in politics? And where does this person stand on this? And what I find is that if you see a pattern in the answers to these questions where multiple people answer the same questions the same way, where when multiple people answer the same questions in the same way repeatedly enough, you can designate someone or something that repeats these identical attributes with a name like Covenanter or Theonomist or Man with Chronic Sinus Pain. And once you do that, you gain a lot of the advantage of saying Bob has 37 liberalness, but you manage to maintain a much higher degree of precision. Like, it's more precise to say David is a 59 level conservative Christian. It's less precise to say that than it is to say that David is a Reformed Covenanter Presbyterian.
Yeah, because that gets, that describes you a lot. It gets to the why a lot faster. Because I mean, there could be 100 liberals in the liberal, on the liberal side of the spectrum, but it doesn't really explain how they got there or why they believe what they believe. Like in the abortion example, I mean, it's there are more positions than for or against, because the for can be limited. There could be qualifiers as well as against. And there are completely different motivations as to why someone gets to that, or very unique motivations as to why someone goes to one category or the other, or one area of the spectrum or the other. But I think the thinking in categories, or describing people in categories, is, like you said, a lot more precise, because I think it puts more value ultimately to that person's opinions. It's maybe takes a little bit more work, but I think it describes a person a lot better and gives their beliefs and motivations a lot more validity.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I realized just now, we've been talking entirely about like doing this for people, but you do this with stuff too. Like a lot of people want to have one number by which they judge the performance of a computer. Like this is a very technical example, but like some computers are really fast at some things and really slow at other things. And sometimes it's not the computer at all, but the internet connection. But a lot of people want to sit down at a computer, use it, and go, oh, this computer is really, really slow. When actually it's the fastest computer they've ever used, but their Wi-Fi is terrible. And if they just had better Wi-Fi, it would fix everything. And they'd be like, oh, this is amazing. Or, you know, even down to things inside the computer. Like this is a really good computer for 3D rendering, but that's actually really slow at opening Microsoft Word for some reason, mostly because it's Microsoft Word. Ayo. So all of that is to say, like, I'd like to do this not just for people and their positions on various things, but I think those are the examples where the reaction to somebody falling outside your spectrum is often the most visceral and hard to accept. But this can be applied to other things like iOS versus Android. There are a bunch of different questions like which is easier to use, which is easier to do this particular thing with, which is more secure in these ways. Like a lot of these things, when it comes right down to it, like if you think about it in spectrum, you may end up using something that's actually worse for you, not because it's a worse product overall, as though there was a spectrum of good to bad for the product, but because it's really good for Fred over here who wants to use it for X, but you want to use it for Y, and it's actually quite terrible at that.
All this programming stuff is tough to follow sometimes.
Yeah, sorry. Let me think of another real quick example. See, this is my life.
Well, I'm bringing up politics because it's a great way for people to kind of identify with the way, you know, with where you're trying to go.
Yeah, yeah.
But perhaps maybe we should just like slightly shift gears a little bit. And I was just thinking, you know, when thinking about this in a categorical way, no, just kidding. I think there's a lot, this spectrum thinking, I think, is a mark of youthful thinking, because it's easier and you don't know enough about the world yet, or the world hasn't changed you enough in very complex ways in order for you to realize, you know, the usefulness of categorical thinking, or if in the evaluation of someone or something. I mean, this is really all about evaluation, evaluating the validity or non-validity of a thing, idea, person, place, or thing. I mean, this applies to all sorts of things, but it's kind of, spectrum thinking is kind of like a mark of youthfulness, and categorical thinking can be not exclusive to older people. I'm not trying to say that, but you know, as you grow in wisdom and you understand that the world is a little bit more complex than you previously thought, and people are more complex than you previously thought, and they become like more confusing to you the more you depend on spectrum thinking.
Right.
And I think people start to struggle with that in their 30s and maybe finally get it after that. They just become remarkably chill people. Like this, how is this person friends with me? He completely disagrees with everything I say, but like he likes me as a person. How is this possible? That's really hard to do when you're in 20s, easier to do when you're 40s.
Yeah. You know? You think in a,
again, I'm not saying,
you think in a complex enough way to not categorize the other person as Hitler because you've put them on the opposite end of a spectrum where you hate the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm saying. It just, it, you know, it forces you to take some time to figure out why a person is the way he is. Because there's just so many. There's just, you know, like when you think about the vices that people engage in, and it's important to note that, you know, a sin is a sin and a vice is a vice. But when you try and figure out, okay, well, this person was, you know, maybe they grew up in a drug home, you know, or they were abused as a child, and that's causing them to exhibit this behavior. And where I would like to just place them on the opposite side of the spectrum is me. I need to kind of categorize them, and it'll help their rehabilitation into society a lot better. Now, that's not to say that I'm just this crazy liberal when it comes to crime and punishment. That's not really what I'm trying to say. You know, rehabilitate this person in jail, but so don't hear me wrong there. But you know, this, you know, in order for society to function, evaluating the whether that's law enforcement or crime and punishment or rehabilitation, categorical thinking, I think, is more useful than spectrum thinking when it comes to how a person is rehabilitated or put it back into society as a contributing member. So there's lots of different applications.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the more that you get into a given field, the more that you are kind of forced to admit that level of nuance. So like, I know you drum, Jim.
Oh,
and if I asked you, like, Jim, what is the best drum kit? You would probably start the answer to that with a "so," because you'd want to know right off the bat what kind of music I'm going to be playing,
so,
if it's going to be recorded versus live. Like, I'm imagining that the best drum kit is really, well, what's the best drum kit for you? Am I right?
Yes, you are right. You know, that's a great example because, and this applies to a lot of different disciplines, but if someone were to ask me who was the greatest drummer of all time, I would probably say, you know, well, so, okay, so what do you mean by this? Like, what kind of music are we talking about? Are we talking about, like, there's the greatest jazz drummer of all time. There is the greatest big band drummer of all time. But it's really hard because of, if you're thinking on a spectrum of getting the greatest drummer of all time.
Right.
There's just so many things go into, you know, the makeup of a drummer for one. Yeah, so it's a great example.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us, like this is kind of what we talked about when we talked about mental models, where, like,
just kidding.
with a mental model, it's often oversimplified. You've chosen to think about the world in this way because you found a way of thinking about it that is, like, just complex enough for you to do your job. And that these things are still helpful. Like, for areas like that you don't care that much about, like, you don't have to have this level of categorical thinking. Like, for example, for me, I don't like either kind of spicy. So for me, if you describe it as like really spicy, I'm not interested. It doesn't matter if it's red or if it's green spicy. And it sounds like you would agree generally with this, Jim. You're not interested because, like, anything north of like 32 on the spectrum, actually, do you know how spicy things get? It's insane. They have a unit of measurement for spiciness. If I go to a Thai restaurant, I order a 3, you know?
Yeah.
It's fine to have these, but when you think about how, like, in whatever career you exist in or whatever creative field you might exist in, like, you think about how you had to learn that level of nuance. I think it's just important to be willing to admit that level of nuance could exist. Like, okay, it's right. For me, it's all just a question of how spicy is it? But I could totally understand why for this other person, it's a question of what kind of spicy is it? You know, for me, I care about how hoppy something is in terms of beer. But for this other person who likes IPAs, they might only like citrus hops and they might not like all the rest of the hops. So you could say, oh, how hoppy do you like your beer? And they're going to respond, so what kind of hops?
I'm like just, that. Yeah, I prefer my IPAs like citrus, more on the citrusy side of things.
There you go.
And I don't like the other kind, you know, the more cough syrupy kind.
So, yeah, it's interesting because, like, I'm contradicting my notes. My notes here say, I'm honestly not sure why anyone would prefer spectrum thinking in the vast majority of cases. But I'm thinking, the more I realize it, when you realize that there's, like, a point beyond which, no matter how nuanced something is, it's too far for you and you don't have to interact with it. It's harder to do this with people because you have to interact with whoever's in front of you. That's your neighbor. And when you try to draw technicalities around who your neighbor is, you get long parables that tell you how stupid you are. But when it comes to something like IPAs or spicy food, like, spectrum thinking can be a helpful way to not learn too much about a thing, but remember one fact about it. That is, I don't like anything past this point.
Yeah, I agree. But we're going to probably, let's close this up.
Yep.
Really helpful discussion today. This was surprisingly kind of like refreshing compared to the normal, you know, Godfather flogging theater drivel that we... Well, I enjoyed it, and that's all that matters.
I actually really enjoyed it. It was fun to do the accent.
Yeah, that was... I mean, come on. How fun is it for me to do, you know, I'm smart! That's just the funnest line to say.
I would give that a 64 on the funness spectrum.
Yes, okay. That was a 67 liberalness of Jim there. No. But no, this is cool. This helps explain kind of my journey and explains why you are the way that you are.
Why you the way that you are. Complex
people ever. Yeah, well, you are. Because you're kind of all, I sometimes like to say you're all over the place, but that's a spectrum thinking kind of way of looking at it, you know? Because if you can't land on one point on the spectrum, but you have to kind of go back and forth as you go through the issues, you know, that's not very useful if you're a spectrum thinking kind of guy.
Exactly.
But when I can finally like take a breath and get you in a category, we can start a discussion. So I think this is, you know, this is really cool validity, but this reminds me anyways, to close, this reminds me of a person that was in my life, that was very difficult to place on a spectrum, and he became more interesting to me because of that. And he, you know, I don't know precisely what category he's in, but he was a martial arts teacher of mine back when I was doing Krav Maga. And this is a guy, it was a very complex person, and I couldn't exactly figure him out. He hated Hillary Clinton, was very socially liberal in a lot of things. Very passionately pro Second Amendment, very a traditional guy, kind of like pull yourself up by your bootstraps, personal responsibility. But it just, you know, he would just go back and forth on the spectrum. I just could not figure this guy out. And he was just endlessly fascinating for me because of that reason. And I've always been drawn to people like that. Like if I immediately, after listening to this person talk after a while, I mean, just if the needle is going crazy on the spectrum, I am immediately interested in that person. Yeah. It makes me more curious. I want to know why, you know, cause that's cool to me. The cut and dried conservative, you know, MAGA forever, MAGA hat, you fill in the blank. That person is not as interesting to me anymore. Used to be when I thought like that. But not that much anymore. I don't know. I don't cross the street for that person. I stay on the other side, and you know, I can't finish the joke. And that is a good sign that the show should end. With the chicken, me and the chicken are just sitting there pecking the ground for food. Anyways,
waiting for a reason.
Good talk. Waiting for a reason. It's like an album title or something. Simon and Garfunkel. Waiting for a reason.
I like that.
I don't know what I'm saying. All right, David. Well, thank you very much for that episode. Do you have anything else to say before we shut this mother up?
I would love for you not to. What is that? Don't do that.
Don't do that to my mom.
No, I have nothing. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye. Goodbye. I don't want to speak. Thank you.
Well, we were ending the show. Now you're not ending the show.
No, I was just talking. Oh, that was funny.
That's how you don't end the show. You don't end the show by continuing to talk. Are we? Okay.
Okay.
Goodbye. Bye, everyone.
No. Bye.
Won't someone save me from this podcast? Is it over or just dragging along? Will these two guys talk? So adventure started off so tongue-in-cheek. Now it seems it's on.